This is In the Circle on D1 Softball.
And we welcome you to this edition of In the Circle on D1 Softball. Eric Lopez alongside Victor Anderson. Coming up momentarily, you're going to hear our big-time chat with Monica Abbott, our first-ever extensive interview with Monica Abbott, who is now into broadcasting. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about life after retirement, what led to that decision. That's all coming up. Monica Abbott joining us here on In the Circle on D1 Softball momentarily. Plus, later on in the show, Victor and I will recap kind of a wacky weekend where 8 of the top 10 teams lost on the week, and some teams didn't get some games in because of Mother Nature that could come back to haunt them. We'll discuss that coming up on this edition of In the Circle on D1 Softball. Victor, where can they follow us?
Y'all know where you can find our social media. Y'all know where to find our YouTube channel. Rate us and review us 5 stars. And none of us, the Yapping Eric, let's get to the interview with Monica Abbott, please, and thank you.
Well, this weekend on Friday night, you may have seen Monica Abbott was part of the broadcast on ACC Network for the NC State-Virginia game. It's her second nationally televised game as a color commentator. She's got 2 more games coming up with Virginia Tech on April 23rd and Missouri at South Carolina on May 4th. I had a chance to talk to Monica Abbott, here on this past Thursday as she was prepping for NC State-Virginia. To discuss this career move for Monica Abbott, what was it that led her to get into commentary broadcasting? How did it get to that point? We talked about her book, Life After Retirement, what led to her decision to retire, and much more. Here now, for the first time, lengthy interview on In the Circle on D1 Softball, Monica Abbott. All right, joining us now here on In the Circle on D1 Softball, we've had her on before. In fact, we had her on right when she made the U.S. Olympic team for Tokyo, and honored to have her back. Of course, she's a 2-time Olympian, 3-time world champion, was the national player of the year in college softball in 2007, holds the NCAA Division I record in strikeouts and wins, is an author, and now a color commentator. It's a lot of titles, but she's well earned there. I speak of the great Monica Abbott. Honored to be joined here on the How you doing?
I'm doing so good. Thanks for having me. It's so good to be back on, and I'm happy to, you know, venture into this new ESPN TV commentating.
Well, that's what I wanted to start with, because you've been doing a lot of stuff since we last had you on the pod, but let's start with that. You've been doing commentary. You just made your debut back on April 6th doing Mississippi State, South Carolina. As we're recording this, you're preparing to do NC State, Virginia on ACC Network this week, and then you still got Virginia and Virginia Tech on April 23rd and Missouri and South Carolina on May 4th. You made this announcement on all over your social media platforms where everybody's like, whoa. So, and the question everybody's asked me since is, and I've been curious, is what got you interested in broadcasting?
Well, I will say, you might not know this, but I actually majored in communications at Tennessee. So I'm an avid public speaker. I've really done tons of those. Obviously, it worked really well through my sport, being able to share my story and write the book, Rise and Shine, and Abbott's A-List, some of those things that have you know, shown my career throughout over the years. I think commentating for me was a natural next step, because there's no way softball wasn't going to be involved in my life. And I had to figure out ways to share my information. You know, I played for a long time at the highest of highest levels. But one thing that I'm proud about in my career is while I continued to play after college, my game continued to grow. You know, I developed another drop ball. I threw harder, you know, in my 30s. And when I was playing for Toyota or Team USA, I threw harder then than I ever did in college. And being able to have that insight of what it takes to take athletes to the next level and what that X factor is for them to really come through and compete in those big moments in college, I felt like, you know, what better way to share insights, what better way to celebrate these future stars.
So is this a situation where you reach out to ESPN and you say, hey, I'm interested in broadcasting if ever an opportunity plays out? How did it all come about to the point now where you're getting a chance to get some games under your belt?
Well, when I officially retired, I kind of took some time to my, I released Rise and Shine, the book that I wrote about my career. And then I took some time to kind of figure out what I wanted to do, right? Where do I want to put myself in next? Did I want to jump into coaching D1? Did I want to coach a smaller school? Did I want to open my own facility? Like, well, where exactly did I want to go? And the more I thought about it, the more I realized like I wanted more impact at an more of an elite level of athlete. So unfortunately, there's not a huge opportunity professionally where I could go and make a living coaching a pro team or being a GM of a pro team. So the next level would be that collegiate level. So I really wanted to have an impact there. I sent some feelers out to some friends at ESPN, and then it kind of all happened pretty quick after that.
How did you feel in the booth doing the Mississippi State South Carolina game? That was your first game nationally for the ESPN there. You worked with Kevin Fitzgerald. I watched it. You sounded excited. I'm just curious, what's it like being in that booth minutes before going on air, and how did you feel compared to being in the circle and pitching?
I was excited. I was excited to be there. I was living in the moment and excited to be able to talk about some of the stories and the research of the athletes that I had done or things that I had been watching throughout their season thus far, to be able to lift them up in those ways. It was fun to even discuss, and I hate to say it, but when things go wrong, right? Like when things go wrong on the softball field, we've all been there. I've been there, unfortunately. Unfortunately, I'm not perfect. But when things go wrong and being able to discuss that in a positive light on things that, you know, I remember one topic I said was, instead of thinking about, hey, I didn't do this, I didn't do this, I didn't do this, think about what do I need to do on this next pitch, and working on those little things in your mindset that can ultimately change the outcome of a pitch or your success in that next big moment.
Well, that's the uniqueness. You've experienced everything as a player, so you can relate to every player on there. That's the beauty of the color commentator role, is you've experienced just about everything, good, bad, and different, from players on the field. So you can relate to that and explain that to the audience, what's going on the field that not really other people can do that haven't played the game. That's the beauty of that role. And I'm assuming as you get more games in there, you're gonna dive into the strategic start part of it. Is something that you enjoy as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I think strategy is going to be super important, especially coming up in this weekend's game that I'm doing, Virginia versus NC State. Virginia is a bubble team right now in the RPI, so they really need to get some big wins to be able to make the postseason play. So I think just strategy for them and how they're using their pitchers and manufacturing runs is going to be really important for them to be continue to be successful. So being able to speak to that when they do it and how Coach Harden chooses to do it will be a lot of fun.
The thing, and I told you this a little bit off the air before we started, was what jumped out to me listening to you was the passion and the excitement you had there to be there. Because a lot of times commentators will come out there, you could tell they're just kind of going through the motions, or hey, they're kind of be monotoner, but you have a passion for the game that I thought showed on the broadcast there. Is that accurate there? That passion, is that part of it too? You want to be around the game because now you're not playing, but you still want to be around that game because you love the game.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it lives in you, right? Like softball lives in me. It lights me up. It makes me excited. I get excited for pitchers when they throw great pitches. I get excited when hitters make good hits and have good at-bats. You know, I can see the effort and the determination in athletes to be successful for their team. And that is fun to watch. It's so entertaining. And yeah, it lights me up.
I know Karen Weekly, your former coach, and Megan Rhodes Smith, who I've talked to on the show, a former teammate, have told me they both that you still follow the game closely, to the point where in the past when you've talked to, when they've had you asked to talk to the tennis players, you know what's already going on around the team. And they're like, whoa, I can't put you on. The players are like blown away by that. Is that accurate that you still follow the game pretty closely from that standpoint?
Well, definitely. And of course at Tennessee, you know, I'm a little bit more invested, my alma mater. So I definitely follow a lot more closely to them. But I understand the investment, right? The investment mentally, the investment physically, the investment spiritually, and I think the investment inside our hearts as athletes and what that means to be to bring it all together with a team, one teammate, not to mention 20 other people on your team, and try to adjust things and change things that your coach is asking you to do, that grind and that investment that we do as athletes. So I understand what that feels like and in all aspects of an individual. So it's easy for me to kind of put myself in their shoes, and because I've been there multiple times, and I've done it multiple times at multiple different levels. So I know what that moment felt like in college. I know what that moment felt like at the Olympics, at the pros, you know, at club ball. So being able to relate to them at that level has been, you know, quite a blessing.
Very blessed. I thought of this when I saw you doing the Mississippi State South Carolina game. Taryn Moad is the pitching coach in her first year at Mississippi State. I don't know if you interacted with her at all during the week, but for me that was like a big deal because I got into softball. The first ever World Series I watched, I've told you this, and I don't think I've told you this, but I'll tell you now. The first World Series I ever watched was when you played Arizona, you and Taryn, Tennessee and Arizona, which is still one of the most watched softball games of all time. That got me hooked. Watching you two play, you know, leading Tennessee, that was leading him to the World Series. He had just won the first ever SEC championship for Tennessee. He won the National Player of the Year. That was, so to me, that was kind of like wild. Did you interact with her at all? And, you know, I don't know if you reminisce when you have talked to her in the past or recently. I mean, that was a pretty monumental moment for the game, for what you both, your teams did that year.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of people still talk to me about how that was one of the first World Series they really watched, and it made them fall in love with the game, and they've been watching softball ever since. Is that Tennessee versus Arizona Women's College World Series final? I thought it was so fun that I got to, Taryn was in, you know, the pitching coach at Mississippi State, and that I was my first game announcing. I got to kind of talk about her impact as a pitching coach since she's left. And, you know, Taryn and I have been good friends over the years. We played together professionally for the Chicago Bandits. And I've followed her as through her coaching career from Ole Miss to Arizona, and some of the younger pitchers that she's brought up as far as like Alyssa Denham, Taylor McQuillan. And then it's so fun to see, you know, the protege of Aspen Wesley coming in, the Mississippi State pitcher.
Yeah.
She literally is throwing the changeup that Taryn Mott threw. You know, she's living and dying on that changeup, just like Taryn did. And it's fun to see that impact cross generations and trickle into the next athlete.
That's a great point. You picked up on that. I noticed that too. And I've seen Aspen throw in this year. It's like, oh, that changeup's a little different now. So you can tell the difference there. Having watched the game today, how do you feel about watching the game today? A lot of teams now use pitching staffs, committees, a little different than back in the day when you threw, and Megan Rhodes has joked about it. She had a nice side, you know, seat to watching you pitch pretty much. That was her role. Occasionally would throw in, but it's a little different now. How do you feel about the game today?
From a pitching standpoint?
Yeah.
I think a lot of teams are going to pitching by committee, right? They're going one time through the lineup, two times, next time through the lineup, they switch, third time through the lineup. But as much as teams are doing that, I do think there's still a lot of aces out there. And I think it's important to develop the ace, and especially in preseason play and early SEC or ACC or whatever conference you're in, because there is times when you're going to want to throw your number one. And that number one is going to have to face hitters more than one time through, more than two times through, more than three times through. And just as hitters get better through the lineup, you know, when they face a pitcher multiple times, pitchers also get better, right?
Yes.
And it becomes more strategic in how you call your pitches and the order of the pitches that you throw. Now, if you don't really have like a strong ace, then being able to combo a pitcher with speed and maybe a changeup, you have two different pitchers, you know, opposites or high and low type of pitchers, then that can be really difficult on hitters as well, because, you know, taking barrel up high to then switching to your next at bat barrel to dropping your barrel can be a difficult change for hitters to do quickly within a game. So I understand both aspects. I think depending on the team, and I love how like a Tennessee has a 1-2. I feel like they kind of have the 1-2 ace. Alabama has an ace. You know, Florida has a 1-2 ace. So I like that aspect of having multiple aces. And then really the thing that I love, whether it's in pitching or across the field in softball right now, is coaches are doing a better job of creating roles, right? So there's larger rosters, you know, 20 players, 25 athletes, even on some teams, but creating roles for athletes. So it creates more opportunity for, say, a number three pitcher, like Missouri has a closer now,
yeah,
and she's dominating, right? But she comes in the seventh inning. That's her role. You know, a pinch runner that goes in to pinch run for a big hitter and then goes to the outfield to play a couple innings because she's good in that, a better outfielder than the other girl. You know, just creating these roles for athletes, I like watching that because it creates accountability for those athletes within the team. And it then therefore creates competition within a team and pushes your team further ahead.
There's so much technology too now in today's game. There's so much information. I'm curious if this was available when you were pitching at Tennessee in the college game, mm-hmm. How much of this would you have used? Would you have just like, oh, this is great? Or were you one that didn't like all that? Because I know there are some softball players that think that sometimes that information could get to your head too much, that too much information could kind of throw you off, that, hey, I just want to throw, I just want to hit. What kind of player were you from that standpoint?
I think the information is so valuable, right? It's pushed our game forward. It's made our athletes better. More importantly, it's made our coaches better across the board, not only from, you know, the college, but all the way down to our club and rec, right? Because the visibility and those athletes that played under all that information in college are now taking that information to their club teams that they're coaching, to their daughters, to their, you know, their rec teams, their individual in group classes or lessons that they teach. Myself personally, I can be honest, my freshman year, I really struggled with the technology piece early in my collegiate career. But as I went through my career, I really learned how valuable it was for me. Not only for me to be, for they taught me how to read a hitter better, you know, Coach Ralph and Karen Weekly, and at that time, Marty McDaniel, they taught me how to read a hitter, but I was also able to see what I was doing and the mistakes that I was making in either my form or in my pitches and why that led to a hit. Why did that lead to a home run? Why did that lead to a walk? Why did this pitch floating over the middle of the plate, you know, lead to the next pitch getting hit? So seeing that sort of data and as I developed through college really made a big impact on me and helped me really, really grow. So early in my career, I was a little bit resistant because I didn't understand it. But later in my career, I definitely grasped onto it. I understood it. It created better feel for myself. I understood the way my body moved and I understood what I needed to do. And understanding what you need to do or what you're looking for or what you're trying to do is really powerful because it creates a better plan.
And that helped you, I'm assuming, extend your career from a professional career and the international game for so long. Like, you know, when you announced your retirement, a lot of people are like, wait a minute, she could still pitch. What is she doing? Like, did that help you in that regard as well?
Oh, yeah. I watched video all through. It definitely helped my form just being, you know, you can't have that long career and like when I retired, I probably could have still thrown 75 plus, you know, for 3, 4, 5 more years. But I knew at that time, like I was ready for the next phase. But I do think having the knowledge, having, you know, the biometrics, knowing my own information made me more successful because I could adjust my body to carry the load, right? To carry the load of an ace, to carry like the load of 100 pitches in a game and not lose speed when I got to the seventh.
We're speaking with Monica Abbott here on In the Circle on D1 Softball. How has life been for you since retirement? What's it been like? Obviously, you're dangling here a little bit of commentary. We're going to talk about the book you came out with. You were an author a year ago. But what has life been like since you retired?
Yeah, it's been really fun, to be honest. It's nice just to be home a lot more, to be able to work on other projects that I wanted to do. For example, like release the book that I wrote with Debbie and Rob Shriver. I've been able to start to get my information out that made me good, which was really important to me. I felt like I needed to pass on the information and knowledge I had. And sometimes that's hard to do when you're playing because I don't know. It's just hard to do when you're playing
because you're still in it. You're still in the middle of it.
You're still in the middle of it. You're in it. Right. So that was really hard for me to do while I was playing. So I was been really passionate about just getting more information and knowledge out there on different platforms and avenues. So yeah, I think it was good. It's been really good.
The best compliment is I remember when you made the announcement that you were retiring, people were caught off guard. I remember I was doing a UCF softball broadcast, and I told Cindy Beaumalone, who was the assistant coach in the U.S. national team that you got to work with at the World Games in Birmingham in 2020. She was shocked. She was like, wait a minute, what? Are you sure? Like, she thought I was lying to her because she felt like you could play 2, 3, 4 more years. What led to, you mentioned that decision. Did you know, was there a time period there, like in Birmingham, did you know in the back of your mind this could be it? Like, was there a plan when you made that decision?
Yeah, so if we go back past that, when I signed the Scrapyard $1 million contract, the original goal was play through the 2020 Olympics, and then I was going to come back 2021, the year after the Olympics, and I was going to retire that year. That was kind of like that when you play a while and you've created a brand and stuff, you need an exit strategy. So that was kind of the strategy. And then obviously COVID happened, the Olympics get pushed back, and then I wanted to play another year after that in Birmingham. I was kind of thinking, okay, do I want to have the opportunity to play in the States another year? What was I thinking? Because I felt like I needed to let the world know, but there wasn't really a good opportunity for me to tell our softball world, like out and give them an opportunity to come and see me play, like, like Derek Jeter had his farewell season, or, multiple, Tom Brady had a farewell season. People kind of know this, right? So I wanted that opportunity, but it really wasn't there for me. So in Birmingham, I actually, Coach Malone, I told her multiple times, I was like, I think this is probably going to be it for me. I'm ready to pass the baton. I think Allie Carta is ready to take over the reins. She's capable now, she can then, Montana has come up as another power pitcher. She's in the, I've been able to mentor her through this and still be a part of that mentoring process and development process for those athletes as they need it. But I think I would almost service them better in that role than as a teammate. And they're already looking at me like that. Miyu Goto played with me under Toyota. I've mentored her through. She ends up coming in for, Japan in the Olympic Games, and now she's a superstar, but I mentored her through her first 5 years. So I felt like my career as an athlete was still strong, but my value as an athlete was in off the field.
Well, and plus you have played, 13 years in Japan too. So that's the thing. Not only are you thinking about, do I retire from USA softball, but then there's the Japan, the pro league, which you've made such a great career. We talked about that when you were on the last time about how much you love playing in Japan and the pro league. And that's why you were excited to be part of that Olympics in Japan. So you had to deal with multiple different, it was like almost like multiple decisions at the same one decision, right?
Yeah. And yeah, it really was. And it was hard to step away from USA. I think that one was probably the hardest, just because, you know, I felt like that was everything to me. I had played for them and represented them as an athlete for so long, but more importantly, it was what I was talking about, you know, that dream, that motivation, that inspiration, and all the events that I was doing with, you know, the youth, right? Like the 12U kids or the 18U kids, they're looking at me from that lens. And I loved representing Team USA. So was it, I think that part, saying goodbye to Team USA was probably the most difficult.
Well, I thought it was fitting that it would end, you know, your last major event with them was at the World Games, winning the gold in Birmingham, Alabama, yeah. Not too far away from Tennessee, SEC no. country. Looks like a full,
that's right.
Is it a full circle moment for you in a way? Was that the perfect, did you thought of that in the back of your mind?
I did. I absolutely did. It was a great opportunity. That stadium in Birmingham, the Bandits, we had won a couple championships there as well. So we had some really good showings there as well. And, you know, is in SEC country, it was definitely full circle and it felt really good. And was just they hosted a great event as well. So shout out to Birmingham and the World Games staff there.
I remember I asked Coach Paul Malone about what was it like to, you know, be on the staff and get to work with you. And she said the biggest thing she learned that she applies to even today to her head coach is to listen. So that's what she did. She felt like she was like a sounding board. That was her best thing, listening to what you had to say, what you were feeling. That sometimes coaches, you kind of forget that, to just listen to the player and what they're thinking and how they're feeling. That can help you as a coach kind of decide and making some game plans there. And she was so blown away how you mentioned the mentorship, how you would talk to each pitcher on the staff. I think Montana Fouts was on that, and just you would mentor them and give them advice and give them feedback. Where did that come from your standpoint, being that type of a leadership, more of, hey, I'm going to kind of take you under my wing here and show you the ropes?
Well, I think it starts with a relationship, right? So you have to get to know someone first with a relationship base before you can really start to give them advice. But if I had to be completely honest, I would shout out back to like when I was a rookie and Lisa Fernandez and Jenny Finch and Jessica Mendoza and Stacey Newman took me under their wing and started to give me advice on different aspects of my career. I will tell you, Lisa Fernandez is the one that, you know, told me, why don't you just, you know, in international softball, you have to have a 3-second pause when you present the ball. She said, and I was struggling. I was like, where do I do my pause in my low position? Da, da, da. She's the one that said, hey, why don't you pause down low?
Wow.
Lisa Fernandez told me that, you know, when we were playing on I think it was a world championship or a Pan Am team together. So I think there is definitely, you have to build the relationship first, but when those athletes, you know, big names in our sport were, you know, investing in me, you know, as I was ending my career, I was like, okay, I need to start investing in other athletes a lot more.
A year ago, as you mentioned, you wrote, came out with your book you wrote, co-authored, Rise and Shine, the Monica Abbott story. It's still out there. I'd encourage people to still get it. The thing that struck me when that came out was you mentioned that in fifth grade, you declared that you wanted to be an Olympian. That was your goal.
Yes. Fifth grade.
And so now that I have you on, I have two questions. Back then, what was it? Why did you want to be an Olympian from that standpoint at fifth grade? Was it you just loved watching the Olympics as a youngster? What led you to make that declaration there? Because that's not something that you hear often. Sometimes they say, well, I want to be a basketball player. I want to do this. But you wanted to be an Olympian. Of course, you were able to accomplish that twice over in a sport that is recent, basically new to the Olympics, not an easy sport necessarily to get into. It's not, as we obviously know the history of it, it hasn't been on every time in the Olympics. But what led you to that as your fifth grader?
Yeah, so I'm not exactly sure, but I can tell you this. When I was in fifth grade, so the big project for fifth graders at that time was a state report. Okay, so I wanted to do California, because I was from there. And then I wanted to do Nevada because I had been there. And then I was like, let's do Hawaii because it looks cool on TV. You know, all those sort of fun, cool states. Like, let's do New York, right? Like all these states. So we basically had a drawing for states inside the classroom, and I got none of the states that I wanted. And I was so mad because I was stuck with like five states. It was like Georgia. I don't know. I'm just throwing states out there. Georgia, Kentucky, and Minnesota or something like that. And I was like, I don't want any of these states. And so my teacher assigned me Georgia. And what is very cool about this story is this state report. It was 1996. I was in fifth grade. It was the first Olympics for softball. And I wrote in my report, like, and so I had a little Olympic section in my report because they were hosting this big event. And I wrote, I'll see you there. I'll be standing on the mound pitching or whatever. And at that time, I had just started pitching, but I apparently believed I was ready to go to the Olympics.
Oh, you foreshadowed the future there.
Yeah. I hadn't started, you know, basketball or volleyball really yet. So
that's wild. 96 Olympics in Atlanta. It's a big motivator for you there. Yeah. So what was it like 12 years, you know, later? You make the Olympic team in 08 in Beijing, which would turn out to be the last softball Olympics until Tokyo, ironically. So you get to say you were the most last two. But did that it had to be emotional when you found out you made that Olympic team because you made the goal, one of your goal dreams there.
Yeah, I mean, anytime an athlete makes an Olympic team, I think it's super emotional and it's an investment. My family, we got like an email of like after the Olympic tryouts, and it had the 18 athletes that were picked. And then later on, they would send another on who the top 15 were. So 18 athletes, and the email went out at like 8 a.m. or something. So we all, you know, everyone got up and were like huddled around the computer and like waiting for the email go in. Everyone held their breath as we read it. Luckily for me, ABB, like top alphabetical order, like I didn't have to search, you know, search down the list of names. I could see my name right away on the top because of my last name. But yeah, everyone jumped for joy. We were all very, very, very excited. And it's a memory that I'll remember for a long time.
It's funny. I talked to a lot of the current, you know, college players today, and I'll ask them, hey, who's your favorite player you looked up? And three names come up a lot. Mm-hmm. Kat Osterman, yep. Jenny Finch, and you. Yep. You're the three names that constantly come up. How does that make you feel that you have young players still today that were inspired in part because of your career, whether it be in college or even the USA softball? Because now, you know, and that's what we'll get. I'll ask you shortly about the Olympics being back in LA, but being in the Olympics does have a big significant impact to young people. They watch the Olympics and they saw you playing in USA softball. And of course they saw you play professionally. They saw you play in Tennessee. That made a big difference. So a lot of players today that are playing.
Right. Visibility, right? Visibility. And the great thing about Team USA and USA softball in particular is in those Olympic years, they do their grassroots tour and they go around. So in 2008, we did like a 40 or 50 game tour stop where we traveled around the country and played in front of these girls, right? We played in front of those athletes in, you know, Bowie, Maryland, and, you know, Hoover, Alabama, and, you know, Salinas, California. We played in these spots. So softball teams, if you're a 12-year-old or a 14-year-old or a 10U kid at that time, or you were in college at that time, you went to that game. That was the thing to do. And so we got to be in front of it. And that's why I think it's so important, the visibility now with TV, podcasts, YouTube, social, all of this is just creating more opportunities for visibility and for athletes to become stars for the next generation and multiply out. But getting in front of them at an event, in the pros, in a clinic, you know, and at a school, all of those sort of things where someone that's an Olympian of my stature or professional can go and speak to these young athletes, it creates dreams, it creates motivation and inspiration. And that's what pushes athletes to the next level.
My dad does. It's a great point. We're speaking with Monica Abbott here on In the Circle on D1 Softball. You write in your book about your journey and how you ended up at Tennessee. So I'm not going to ask you about that. I want people to read the book and find out there. But I am curious, when you look back at making that decision to go to Tennessee, have you ever wondered, wow, how so well that worked out and what a big decision that was? Because I would argue that you and Peyton Manning are the two most recognizable athletes from Tennessee. Like, when Tennessee athletics get brought up, you and Peyton Manning get brought up. Peyton Manning usually is at football game. People bring you up at Tennessee softball games. So you've become, and you're a Hall of Famer. You were the first All-American there ever. When you look back in that time in Tennessee, what pops into your head?
You know, let me say first, the Tennessee chapter in the book is probably my favorite chapter that we wrote, because there's definitely some really cool full circle moments and stories that really showcase, I think, what it takes to be a college athlete and the struggles and triumphs you go through. But definitely one of my favorite chapters. When I think about my decision to go to Tennessee, I literally think that God played a part. This was God's hand putting me at that school, because I did have opportunity to go at the time, you know, to the top softball schools, and Tennessee wasn't, they were a bubble team. They were coming up, they were getting votes, but they had new coaching staff. They were turning the program around. And I felt like I could go there and make an impact. I felt like I could go there and create something really cool and be a part of something. And I was really excited about the fact that they didn't just love sports. They loved women's sports. And not every school does that, unfortunately. You know, it's changing a lot more these days. But at the time, to be able to celebrate women's sports as much as they celebrated men's, that played a huge role for me.
It did. No, it was a great chapter. I encourage people, again, check out the book on there. I'm curious, how do you feel you're different now? What are some things you know now you wish you would have known when you were playing at Tennessee and even in your younger pro?
Everything.
There you go.
Everything. You know, when you're in college and you're 18 to 22 or 21, you're in a bubble. You're a little narrow focused. I was very much that way. I was narrow focused. I definitely wish I had been more outgoing earlier. I wish I had understood my pitching a little bit better when I went to college. I knew what I was doing. I couldn't verbalize that, hey, your front foot didn't get down or your thumb went out when you snapped it. That's why it screwed instead of raised. I couldn't verbalize those things. I had to learn that while I was there. Gosh, there's so many things. I wish I had been able to be more myself and not so, I don't know, just not so wrapped up in everything. Just hindsight's 20/20, you know, you're so narrow focused and you're in it. And then you leave college and you're watching college softball on TV and you're like, wow, she's going to get a hit here. Or oh, she's going to strike out this girl on this pitch right here. You can foresee things happening. And you're why couldn't I foresee it happening when I was playing, when I was standing in the circle? Why didn't I know that, hey, Monica, if you get your front foot down a little bit earlier and you're a little bit longer on your release, your changeup will not go 60 miles an hour.
I guess you got to go through it, right?
I did not learn that until I left college.
That's why you go through it, right? You gotta, can't know it all right away. It'd be too easy.
It'd be way too easy. We wouldn't want that.
Oh man, that's pretty good. I mentioned obviously the Olympics now is going to be officially back in Los Angeles. What's your reaction to that? And what advice would you give whoever's going to be on the U.S. national team in 2028? Or even any of the softball players in that Olympic stage? And what advice maybe you would give LA as far as hosting that softball event in LA?
Okay. Advice for, first off, LA 2028, that's a huge deal for our sport. And then hopefully we're going to get Melbourne.
Brisbane, 2032, yeah. Mm-hmm.
In Australia. So just putting that out as well. Just honestly, it creates opportunities for what female athletes and women in our sport. The Olympics is the highest level of our sport, and softball needs to be in it. So it's not like, you know, we have a huge pro league or something else. It's the highest level for softball. For the athletes, I think what the biggest thing that I would say is, one, enjoy the moment in the process, but I would almost tell you over prepare yourself for everything. Think about not so much like, how do I swing at this pitch? Obviously the softball stuff you're going to have to over prepare for, right? The game's gotten better, but think about things like, okay, what if I'm tired? What if it's raining that day? What if I'm really nervous? How do I prep that stuff? What if my adrenaline's pumping and I can't control it? Okay. What if the umpire has, don't just hit, like, what if the umpire has a wide zone? What if the umpire's zone changes every inning? Like, these sort of things happen in the Olympic Games. And you don't always think about some of those things when you're preparing, because you just don't as an athlete, but there, you know, you do have to deal with that stuff. Like, what if you're late because, you know, the bus is late? You know, I remember in the 2008 games, we were playing Japan. This is a famous story. I don't know. Hopefully some of you have heard it already, but this is a famous story. We're playing Japan. We're all warmed up. And Kat is going to pitch this game. We're in pool play. And this is basically whoever wins this game wins the pool. And so you want to win the pool, so you have better seating in the medal rounds. And so we're playing Japan. Kat's going to start. So I'm not even thinking about starting or anything like this. And Coach Candrea goes up to the home plate. They exchange lineups, and Japan is pitching like their number two or three pitcher. They're not pitching their number one. So he comes back. He comes back to the dugout and he tells Stacy Newman and Coach Chuck D'Arcy, who's the pitching coach, and myself. And he says, Monica, you're starting this game. You have 10 minutes. 10 minutes.
Wow.
10 minutes before the next. So 10 minutes before the game starts, 8 minutes before I have to be out there for national anthem and all of that. And he goes back in, he enters me into the game as the pitcher. And I had to warm up and be ready to go to face Japan in 8 minutes.
No and pressure.
30, you know, most pitchers, normally we'll take 30-minute warm-up about, you know, this is a good rule of thumb, 30 minutes. And so I was in the bullpen rushing to warm up. But in those Olympic game, in that Olympic tour, we prepared for that. We did okay, Monica, you have to do a hurry up warm up. What is the warm up that you're going to do that's going to take you 5 minutes or 10 minutes? You don't have 30 minutes. The bus was late, because that's how you transport from the village. You have to go through security. There's all these processes in the Olympics, like things that just take a lot of time. And so we're late. Our warm-up time is going to be cut short. Can you be ready in 5 minutes? Can you be ready in 10 minutes? And so we did, all of the pitchers went through these routines. So when Coach Candrea came back to the dugout and said, hey, you're in, our first was like, oh my gosh, we're pitching. Oh my gosh, don't panic. And then we're like, don't panic. We're ready. We can do this. We can do this. Fastball. Okay, I'm ready. And so, anyways, I ended up going in, and, you know, Crystal Bustos probably hit two home runs, and we won.
It worked out.
We ended up winning the game. But, you know, just being that, having that feeling of over-prepared for things that may, obviously, prepare for your pitchers, prepare your body, prepare your mindset, your skill, all of that stuff. But don't forget to prepare for things like being able, if you can't do your normal routine, you know, if you don't have time to visualize, or you don't have time, you know, it's raining or it's really hot, or, you know, you're sweating profusely because you're really nervous. Like, what are those things? Prepare for those things. And the team that manages those the best is going to be more successful.
8 minutes notice. Man, yeah. Holy smokes. That's you worked out. You figured it out. I mean, that's a good lesson there. Always be ready, right? Never know when your number could be called, no matter what.
Yeah, that was, I mean, obviously not an ideal situation. And, but we pulled it off.
I love the gamesmanship too. Like, oh, we got to change pitchers.
I know, right? Like, oh my gosh, their number one's not starting.
Oh my goodness, that's wow. That's,
you're going in.
You're going in.
Okay, coach.
What are you gonna say? No, like, okay, I'm ready to go.
Okay, coach, I'm ready. I think.
That's great. You mentioned Kat, obviously. Last time you on, you made it clear you were so excited that she decided to join you in that Olympic team. You talked her in, you know, wanted to talk to her. Please come back. Because you two are really good friends for a long time. Mm-hmm. What did it mean to share that one last Olympics together? And I'm fascinated both of you still to this day are giving back to the game. Off, you know, whether it be lessons, whether it be chalking the young people, you know, you give back to the game. But what did it mean to share that last stage in the Olympics with her together one more time?
Yeah, you know, I think it was awesome. We've played together on Team USA. We know each other's history. We complement each other in our pitching ways, of course. I think one of kind of the fun thing was fire and ice. We kind of nicknamed ourselves like I throw the fire and she kind of throws the ice of, you know, she throws slower, a lot more spinny type of pitcher. So just that was kind of a fun way that we kind of took our bond to the next level and that our teammates rallied around too. They even made some shirts at one point. So just kind of a fun thing. And, you know, being able to have Kat on the Olympic team just and being able to share, being someone to back up the knowledge that I was saying, you know, hey, like, this is how it's going to be. It's good when you say it, but when you have someone else to back you up,
right?
And of course, her own knowledge that I would back up as well. So
it's a good 1-2 punch. Yeah. It's a nice, take some of the load off. Fire and ice. I've never heard about the shirt part. I've heard about the fire and ice nickname, but I've not heard about the shirt. That's something. Wow. Matt, is there a way we can find out how this shirt looks like, or is this like top secret here?
No, I'll see if I can get you a photo. All right.
That's pretty sweet. No, that's pretty awesome there. When you look back at your career, you're a Honda Award winner. You won the national player. Do you look back at your accomplishments, awards? Is there one that stands out that maybe you're the most proud of all the achievements you've had and records you've had?
At collegiately?
Or just even pro, international, anything that stands out?
I think things that stand out to me, I think the NCAA strikeout record, I think that was a big one for me. And then I think the NCAA wins is a big one as well, that are both, I think, I'm really proud of. And then taking a team to the Women's College World Series for the first time is something I think is incredibly special. If you're a team that's never been, a college that's never been, and you go for the very first time to Oklahoma City, like being able to get your team there is just a moment for that college that can be unmatched. And I was able to do that with the 2005 Tennessee team. And, you know, it was incredible. Those memories, I even have a little bit of chills talking about it, just because it does mean so much, not only to us as athletes, but to the university and to the alumni and to the fans of the Tennessee softball program. So I think that being the first in that aspect is just incredible. And then professionally, I think awards and all of that and wins are really great. But when I think about my career as a whole, I'm really proud of the fact that as I played over the years, I feel like I got better. You know, I definitely had a growth mindset that was instilled in me from my college days, where I just continued to get better as an athlete. I started to throw harder. I started to like tinker with the way that I worked out and trained or ate or thought about the game. And I just continued to evolve. And for me, that's probably one of the proudest things about my career.
Rightfully so. That was tremendous. And, you know, I covered a lot of your games in the pros. Mm-hmm. I'll never forget you had to deal with all these long lines of fans that wanted to get your autograph. And you were patient. You signed just as many as you could before security would say, you got to go. You got to get going. But you've always been nice there. You've always been incredible for that standpoint in the game. Tell the people now, you're obviously getting, we're dabbling into the broadcasting side, but I know you're still involved in other areas. What, where can people kind of follow you and kind of what do you want to do? You know, do you have other goals outside of softball that you want to accomplish? Or maybe it's within softball. Obviously, broadcasting is a part of it, but is there other goals you have left?
Yeah, so you can find information on me, obviously, on my website. That's going to be the best place to go, with monicaabbott.com. If you're, and then social, my biggest platform is probably going to be Instagram. That's where I spend most of my time, Instagram. But, you know, that's where you can find out more information. My goal is to, like, get, obviously, more information out there, so virtually, so that there's different levels that people can get, you know, qualified information, right? I would consider myself a qualified person to speak on pitching and to teach pitching. So different price points, different levels that people can enter to learn pitching or become a better pitcher. And then hopefully some big events here coming up. A few events a year to help take athletes to the next level. That's kind of where I'm at.
Couple of athletes that are taking their game to the next level is that you probably follow pretty close is Pickens and Gottschall at Tennessee. Yes. When you see them, what comes to your mind when you see them, especially Pickens, who people are just marvel at how hard she throws and her explosiveness. She's in the mix for SEC Pitcher of the Year as we talk. But what goes to your mind when you see those two?
Yeah, I think they are incredible. I love how they're pitching right now. I love their determination. I love Peyton Gottschall's mindset and focus. And honestly, her pace of play in the game, I think is really, really good as a pitcher. It's just her pace of the play, being able to create that rhythm for the team. Carlin, I think the consistency piece, right? The consistency of speed, but more importantly, the consistency of the low zone is really good for her with that speed. So she's really able to bring it on that low, you know, that knee height, low outside corner and low inside corner. And that's huge for just zone separation and also being able to, it's hard to hit, you know, 70 plus miles an hour on the low inside corner. That's difficult.
That is very
hard. It's hard, but no. We're actually working on taking, you know, we have an event in the mix. We haven't announced it yet, but in early August, a 3-day event for our top power pitchers in the country. So look to see that release sometime later this month. And hopefully we'll have a few of those power pitching, NCAA athletes, including, you know, in the mix as coaches.
Folks, that's why you got to follow her. She's going to get that information there. Subscribe to her newsletter on the website, because I know you give a lot of options there. You do great stuff there. And make sure you all tune in to her color commentating, which is exciting. NC State, Virginia, April 12th. Virginia Tech, April 23rd. And Missouri, South Carolina, May 4th. Welcome to the media side, Monica.
Thank you. So happy to be here.
Thanks for doing this. I know it's a busy time, but always a fan. Looking forward to hearing you on the commentating. But thanks for everything you do for the sport of softball and helping it grow the game. And thanks for taking the time to talk to us here on In the Circle on D1 Softball.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Eric.
And thanks again to Monica Abbott for taking the time from her busy schedule to talk to us. Again, make sure Virginia Tech, April 23rd over the ACC Network game. She'll be on Missouri, South Carolina, May 4th. Of course, she did Mississippi State, South Carolina, April 6th. And, of course, did this weekend's NC State, Virginia game. And, of course, that Mississippi State, South Carolina game, as you heard me and Monica talk about, perhaps a little ironic and fitting because, obviously, she got to do a game that involved Taryn Mowat, Mississippi State assistant coach, who she battled back in that 2007 famous national championship series between Tennessee and Arizona, which to this date is still one of the most, if not the most watched college softball games of all time. And of course, as you've heard her, she's good friends with Taryn. But Victor, that's the big story to me. And is that Monica doing the commentary? I got to watch some and listen on the Friday night, just her second game. She's getting used to it. She's like, loved her passion to that. She could tell she's got an energy and a passion in the booth. And I'm fascinated to see where this goes, but it's good for the game when you have one of the greatest of all time involved still in the game, and especially on the commentary side.
And this continues, Eric, a trend of seeing the great players of our sport, of the last generation, starting to provide their commentary on this generation's of players. We have Kat Osterman multiple times in a podcast talk about her journey from being a player to being a coach to now being a broadcaster. Francesca Anaya doing it in the reverse end, being a great commentator and now going into coaching. We're seeing this all around the sport. Alex Powers, All-American of Florida State, your partner with UCF Games. We're seeing more and more former players realize that they can impact.
Oh, Natasha Wiley
as well. Thank
is
you.
Doing games on Pac-12 Network, yes. And has done games on ESPN as well. I mean, that's another example right there of some of the greats in the history of the sport. Of course, Jessica Mendoza is obviously one of the standards there as well. So, yeah, you're right. It's awesome to see. It's fun. And I'm just excited to see Monica talk. And obviously, she talked about that book she wrote, came out last year, which was a pretty good book, Rise and Shine, the Monica Abbott story. Make sure follow that book if she goes in detail about her life. Or she mentioned, and we talked about it, being a fifth grader saying, I want to be an Olympian. And I think she did that times too. And so it's awesome to see her obviously involved in the games and around. And like I said, I'll check it out when I'm not on the air. I'll check her out on the broadcast, and looking forward to seeing how that progresses in her move. In fact, you know, another great player, it was just announced this week and made her debut on Sunday night on SEC Network Rally Cap. Haley McClenny is now part of the Rally Cap crew there on SEC Network on Sunday night's cover, recapping SEC softball. So we're seeing a lot of these big names, obviously, in the sport, and should be a lot of fun. But, hey, that was awesome. Thanks to Monica Abbott for doing this. It was our first ever extensive interview with her. We've had her on once before. It was right when she officially made the Olympic team for Tokyo, yep. And they had her on for about 10 minutes, which was brief, because we had ironically enough, we had Monica Abbott and Haley McClenny back-to-back.
Yes, we did.
For 10 minutes, and they're both now in commentary. But it's awesome to hear Monica. And obviously, follow Monica in all the social places. You see, she's got some big stuff coming, working on later on this year, as she kind of teased there a little bit in the interview. But we'll certainly it was good to talk to Monica in depth and about a lot of different topics. We could have gone for hours, but she has a life. So
yes, she does.
Should be good. Of course, she talked at the end about Tennessee and that 1-2 punch of Pickens and Godshaw. And ironically, Tennessee this weekend played Taryn Moat and Mississippi State. Coming up on this edition of In the Circle, we'll recap a wild weekend in college softball and where we stand as we're another week closer to Selection Sunday. You're listening to In the Circle on D1 Softball.
Now, Eric, funny you should mention that Monica Abbott and Taryn Moat had their history. We had Taryn Moat on our previous podcast before. And also, we had Haley McClenny on the podcast before. So, if you want to listen to those episodes again, download In the Circle on your favorite podcasting platform. Raiders and reviewers, 5 stars. Another month of the top 25 of good pods, ladies and gentlemen. So, keep that positive momentum and energy going. And if you follow us on our YouTube channel, you found out about the latest edition of Yeah, I Said It. I won't tell Eric what I talked about, but let's just say I have some words for the softball fans that were addressed in that particular segment. So, and by the way, ladies and gentlemen, we strongly suggest you subscribe to our YouTube channel, because as we get closer to May and conference tournaments and the selection show, our content on our YouTube channel is going to start really ramping up. So subscribe, turn on those notifications now, because we have some fun things up our sleeves coming up in the next 6 weeks or so.
We had Kat Osterman, by the way, on recently, a few weeks ago.
Yes, we did.
Not too many podcasts can say they've had Kat Osterman and Monica Abbott within a few weeks of each other. So thank you very much for that. Obviously, a wild week in softball. 8 of the top 10 teams in the country lost at least a game during this past week. 4 of them actually lost a series.
Mm-hmm.
One team that did not lose was Texas. They took care of business. They beat Texas State and beat Baylor. Let me just say this. I'm glad I was not on the last episode. There's a lot of stuff going on. I was broadcasting a UCF's Jacksonville game, which was a really big cause, you know, obviously.
Yeah, autism awareness, yes.
So I'm glad I didn't go on, because otherwise I would have been off on this. But I just want to make this clear.
Uh-oh.
To any poll voters.
Oh, boy.
Out there,
I mean, ladies and gentlemen, I would like to put this disclaimer. The views about what is about to be said are those of Eric Lopez and Eric Lopez alone, and do not necessarily reflect the views of Inner Circle, D1 Softball, or any of his partners or affiliates.
If you voted for Texas or Oklahoma last week, I got no issues with you.
None.
Fine.
None.
If you voted for anybody other than Texas and Oklahoma, you really probably should not be voting in a poll. That's my
wow.
Thank you very much.
Do you want to say, Eric? You have to say, "Yeah, I said it" after saying something that bold.
Sure, no, you got that old copy.
I am giving you permission for a take like that. That is worthy of that particular saying.
That's all I gotta say. That's all I'm gonna leave it as that.
Okay.
That's all I'm gonna say. please take this seriously. If you're gonna vote, take it seriously. Anyway, that's enough on that. I will say this: Texas should be this week the unanimous number one.
They won.
After Oklahoma losing to BYU. Now, Oklahoma won the series, but they dropped the game against BYU. Credit to the Cougars on that win, 9-4 at Love Field. Duke, who some people thought was number one, got beat by Campbell. Now, they bounced back, beat a shorthanded Clemson team in Clemson, South Carolina. Their good series win for them. But to me, Texas right now should be the number one seed. I can tell you this right now. Victor, as I'm working on my latest bracketology, which will come out this week, Texas will be the number one overall national seed.
Oh, boy.
No, that's a fact. I mean, there's no debate. They have the best resume in the sport. Like, that's right now, it's not disputable. They have the best resume. They have the most top 25 wins. They have they just have the best resume right now. Keyword
right now.
Yes. So they're the ones.
But Eric, the problem is, and I addressed this a lot on I said it. You said everything, but the fans are going to not listen to those two words right now and go goo goo gaga over it. But
that's why I keep making bracketologies, because people click and react. That's fine. But I'm just telling you, Texas right now has the best resume in the sport. And
fair.
They would be, if the season ended today, they would be the number one overall seed. I know some are going to say, Oklahoma is on top in the Big 12. Remember, the committee does not look at conference standings. That is not a factor. Case in point, 2 years ago, where UCLA was seeded higher than Arizona State.
In spite of the fact Arizona State beat UCLA in the head-to-head and was ranked and had a better record in the conference than the Bruins.
Right. They won. Right. I believe they won the. Yeah. So that's. I could tell you in talking to the committee, that is not a factor. They look at it, the whole body of work and your resume. They don't compare teams. That's what they say. So
keep that
in mind before you at me about, hey, well, they're on top of the league. And I'm not saying, by the way, that I do think conference standings should matter to some extent. However, here's why I'm on the losing case on this. As these conferences get bigger and bigger, Victor, it's going to be the conference.
It's more unbalanced.
Irrelevant.
It's going to be a more
unbalanced. The ACC does not play everybody.
Then it's going to get
certain
even
teams that play a softer schedule than others. That's why, and that's something that has been pointed out to me by committee members, why they don't look at conference standings. And I think that's going to be more true moving forward.
Yes.
Where conference standings do not matter as much as we would like to think it does, because they play completely different schedules. The Big Ten's another example of that. And SEC is another example, et cetera.
It's only going to get worse with the Big Ten adding UCLA, Washington, and Oregon. It's going to get worse with the SEC adding Oklahoma and Texas, the ACC with Cal and Stanford, the Big 12 adding the four corner schools. It's only going to get worse, folks. So before you harp on, well, so-and-so is third in the SEC, but so-and-so is sixth in the SEC. How come you got them higher ranked in your bracket? You cannot properly assess a team in a conference if you're not playing the same schedule within the conference.
That's why I have to do with it. When I do my projection, I'm trying to do how the committee is going to do it. So speaking of UCLA, Evidently, they're getting a head start on Big Ten weather because
– oh, gosh.
They got washed out and then some against Cal. They only got one game in this weekend.
Mm.
They had weather issues on Saturday that pushed them to play a doubleheader on Sunday, except the field conditions were not playable on Sunday. This is the third conference home game that UCLA has had washed out, or whatever you want to call this.
Impacted by weather.
Including to the field, because obviously the field, you know, we talk about renovations. Boy, it would be nice to renovate the state where you could maybe handle water. Nonetheless, UCLA now has lost two games against Cal. They lost a game earlier this year against Oregon. And remember,
they got rained out of three games in Clearwater where they would have played Tennessee, UCF, and North Carolina. So that's six games that the Bruins have lost because of Mother Nature. How much, Eric, is that going to impact the Bruins knowing they got a big series in Stanford against the Cardinal coming up this weekend and would have been off for a week since they beat Cal 3-1?
Well, not only that, I mean, forget the bigger issue there is how is that going to affect the resume? Because Cal would have been a top 25, top 30 RPI games you lost. You lost a game against Oregon, which is a top 30, top 35 RPI. UCF right now is a top 30 RPI team. You have Tennessee's obviously top 10. I mean, those are resume games that you didn't get a chance to play that could put you on the bubble to host because you didn't get those games in beyond your control. And I don't know. To me, the Pac-12's in trouble from this standpoint. Washington lost games in Clearwater. It's hard, you know, it's going to be interesting. The Pac-12 has had at least three host sites in an NCAA regional since 2005. That is in serious jeopardy right now, and it's the most underlying story that I don't think anybody's talking about. You know, everybody's assuming if you look at the rankings, well, Washington's a top 10, UCLA. You look at the res. Washington's 25 right now in the RPI. UCLA kind of in the teens. It's in the bubble range.
UCLA is 17 RPI as of this recording.
Now, that could change, by the time Monday and Tuesday. But the point is,
as of us recording this Sunday night, UCLA, Washington, and 25 RPI as well.
Yep. And again, historically, since 2008, the lowest RPI a team has gotten to host as a one seed is 19. It's happened a couple times. So you want to be in the top 19 to host, usually. You mentioned UCLA-Stanford. That becomes even bigger for UCLA to get a result that weekend because they're running out of time to improve that resume. And that could be a difficult situation for the committee to figure out is, do they give them the benefit of the doubt because they got hurt by things they couldn't control like Mother Nature? Or does that cost them? I don't know the answer to that. I've never had to deal with a team in this situation where they've lost games due to Mother Nature. The closest thing I could think of was COVID year 21, where teams lost games because they had to
forfeiting and things like that, COVID
and all that. So I don't know. That's just something to monitor with the Pac-12. Stanford right now is the only lock to host. I personally think there will be a second Pac-12 team.
The question is who?
Hard to believe. I don't know who. And then that Pac-12 tournament in Stanford, it might take another scenario like last year where the team that makes a run and gets to the final or wins that Pac-12 tournament that's not Stanford might get themselves a host spot. Remember Utah last year. So that's what we're looking at.
They did.
In a weird, weird Pac-12 year, a very bizarre year, a year where this weekend even Stanford loses on a walk-off Sunday to Oregon State, which probably takes them out of the running for the number one overall national seed at this point. With that loss and a loss to Sacramento State, that's a couple of questionable ones there for Stanford from a number one overall national seed. You have Arizona winning a series against Oregon. Utah sweeps Arizona State with a bizarre Saturday night game that was delayed twice. It was delayed because both teams decided to wear white, which that's a no-no.
Whoops. And
then it got delayed multiple hours because a bunch of bees decided to crash the party and hit the netting on the softball stadium in Tempe.
Uh-huh.
Were you on the air?
I was on the air that day. I have my own upset.
And then the game finally does resume. Utah jumps out to a 10-0 lead Arizona State comes all the way back, gets within 10-9, bases loaded, only to lose 10-9. Maybe one of the most bizarre games of the year in the Pac-12, Utah. But that's a big win for the Utes to sweep a team in Arizona State right now that's kind of limping a little bit. So that's kind of the wacky story in the Pac-12, which it's going to be interesting with Stanford, UCLA coming up this next weekend coming up, and then down the road, Stanford and Washington.
Yep, and another thing, Aaron, to keep in mind, Washington took 2 out of 3 versus UCLA. I know they don't consider that as a part of the criteria, but if it comes down to that, and here's the other thing to consider, Eric, and I'll just briefly mention this. Looking at the resumes between UCLA and Washington, it's not that much of a difference. UCLA probably has the best win of them. They have the win versus Tennessee at Mary Nutter. While Washington, to make the argument, their best win is taking 2 out of 3 versus UCLA, beating Oregon.
But they're going to have to really finish strong here. Yes. They're going to have to make a big push here. This is nowhere near a lock at all.
Nope.
With either team right now going into the rest of the season. So on that. So that's the story of the Pac-12 over the SEC. Tennessee comes back, wins the last two games of the series in Starkville to take 2 out of 3 from Mississippi State after Mississippi State took the first game run-rolling Tennessee. The Vols, to me right now, are clear-cut the best team in the SEC, period. I don't even think now LSU loses 2 out of 3 at home to Auburn. Although, in the middle of that, Kelly Lynch
threw a no-hitter on Saturday.
Throws a no-hitter against the Tigers. Justin McCloud was there. In fact, let's go ahead, Vic. Play the clip. Justin McCloud in the postgame with Kelly Lynch, a historic 7-inning no-hitter for Kelly Lynch and LSU beating Auburn from Saturday night. That was Kelly Lynch following her no-hitter on Saturday, courtesy of Justin McCloud of D1 Softball. That's the beauty, D1 Softball. We got staffs all over the world.
Yes, they do.
Replay covering games.
Oh, by the way, Eric, funny you should
mention. Auburn comes back and wins the series, winning the game on Sunday.
But LSU has a chance to bounce back. They play Tennessee but on the road this weekend. So if LSU wants to get back in the conversation to be a top eight national seed and to be the number one contender for Tennessee in the SEC.
Well, I'm thinking about this week for LSU. They got Louisiana on a midweek, and then they've got Tennessee on the road in Knoxville, as you mentioned.
Yeah.
Big series. Hopefully for them it goes better than the LSU baseball team it went for in Knoxville, because they got swept in baseball this weekend, beat up by Tony Vitello and the Vols.
Oh, the jokes I could have about that, but I will refrain to do so.
I still think LSU's in pretty good shape. I think a lot of people overreact. Well, because that's what people do.
Softball fans do that. See, I
think LSU's still in pretty good shape, top eight seed-wise. Because, folks, I don't know if you know, but, like, everybody lost.
Everybody lost this weekend.
So, I still think, that being said, you're right, though, that Tennessee series looms big. Louisiana looms big. Georgia continues. They're scuffling now. They've lost, I believe, 3 straight series, losing in Lexington, Kentucky, 2 out of 3 to Kentucky.
Yep.
Georgia might be the team that's in trouble as far as the top eight is concerned. Missouri takes 2 out of 3 at home against Florida. Florida had a weird week. They won that wacky Monday night game against LSU, only to lose to South Florida at home for the first time. They lose to the Bulls since 2012, lose 2 out of 3 to Missouri. They're now kind of in that bubble hosting spot with them and Florida State, et cetera. So that's kind of unique. Arkansas wins 2 out of 3 against South Carolina. They've probably been the most consistent team other than Tennessee right now in the SEC. So Tennessee, to me, is clearly the best team in the SEC. And as of right now, I would have them in the top 4 national seed.
I agree. And I'll be fascinated to see how Tennessee responds, because you got LSU, Alabama, Kentucky to wrap up the regular season. So I'll like to see, be intrigued to see how the Vols wrap up things and decide to go for their second straight SEC championship.
Correct. Obviously, the big story in the Big 12, Oklahoma drops a game to BYU. So they've now had 3 losses in the conference. They're still on top of the Big 12, but only up a game on Texas. And remember, Texas has the tiebreaker. So we got an interesting finish there in the Big 12. Oklahoma State loses to Iowa State. There goes Jamie Pinkerton. This is what he does.
Yes, what he does.
You don't want, You don't want to play the Cyclones come the second half of the Big 12 year. They're making their push as they usually do. They take two out of three from Oklahoma State, which pretty much knocks them out of the Big 12 title race there. Now they're going to fight, try to be just to make sure they're a host, which I still think they are, but they may not be a top eight right now. So that's the story there. Texas Tech wins two out of three at home against Kansas. Kansas won a wacky 15-12 game in eight innings, which I can't even explain. There's too much time. But nonetheless, big series win for Craig Snyder to win that series. Big for Kansas, though, to not get swept, take a game at least there. UCF sweeps Houston. And when I mean sweep,
they dominated Houston.
Outscored them 27-2. They've outscored. In fact, going back to the midweek game against Jacksonville where they had a no-hitter, 9-1. They've outscored teams now 36-3 this week for UCF. So they are strongly now peaking at
very
the right
quietly, Eric. UCF has won 9 in a row, 11 of their last 12 after being swept by Texas in early, right. in late March. They got FAU in the midweek. They go to Baylor.
Yeah.
So
big series.
A big series, big opportunity for UCF because they got Baylor who's on the ropes. They got FAU, Bethune-Cookman before Norman, Oklahoma comes to Orlando in the form of the three-time national champion Sooners.
That'll be electric. Should be interesting. We'll have some shows from there that week. But speaking of FAU, they lose two out of three to North Texas,
mm-hmm.
and the American's a mess. FAU still on top of the American, game up on North Texas, a game up on Tulsa, who quietly is now tied for second in the American. Wichita State loses two out of three in Tampa to South Florida. Big week for Ken Erickson and the Bulls with a win against Florida.
Yep.
Two out of three against Wichita, getting themselves back in the bubble conversation there. But the Americans all over the place. Charlotte's also in second place. They swept UTSA like they were supposed to. They have by far the best resume in the American. I think they're the safest team into the tournament. But, I mean, it's a mess in the American as far as trying to sort that out right now. As far as the postseason is concerned, same Big Ten. Penn State lost to Michigan State. Whoa, didn't see that one coming.
No, usually the inner circle mojo works well, but
they did win the series.
They did.
Indiana swept Minnesota to try to keep their bubble hopes alive. Michigan in a wacky series swept Iowa in a game where Iowa led every game.
Iowa led 8-1 and 5-1 in the two games on the doubleheader Saturday. Michigan came back to win, a big win for the Wolverines. Heartbreaking loss for Coach Gillespie and company. The Big Ten, Eric, it just feels to me it's Northwestern, Penn State, and Lord help us trying to figure out the rest of the league. Doesn't it feel the same way to you?
Yeah, I mean, right now Northwestern's the team to beat. Penn State's right there. Maybe Michigan and Indiana. Michigan did sweep Indiana. Keep that in mind.
They did.
Maybe you get a third team in that way.
I don't know.
But I will see. I haven't done my work on that. I haven't gone that in depth yet. That's what the next 48 hours are for me going to look like.
Good luck for you.
One thing that will change in the Sun Belt. Louisiana wins the series against Texas State. They went two out of three.
But you know what happened, Eric? Jerry Glasgow didn't have to say a word to his team going into this week's series. He just had to look at the tweets and the posts, everyone talking about, can Texas State host? Texas State in line to host. And Louisiana just said, okay, let us remind all of you who the tribal chief of the Sun Belt Conference is. By the way, that is 85 straight Sun Belt Series 1 for the Raging Cajuns. And I think Louisiana reminded everybody this weekend that while the Sun Belt tournament is hosted in San Marcos, the road through the Sun Belt still go through Louisiana.
I would agree with that. I think they've jumped Texas State in the mix to host. So I agree. I agree there. I think the question is, I think we're right back where we were a year ago. Louisiana in the mix to host, maybe in position to host. But does somebody come out of nowhere to take it away, i.e. Utah last year, for example?
But the problem is, Eric, there are more teams. I think there's maybe three spots to host. And we'll talk about – I'm sure you'll go over this more in your bracketology on D1Softball.com. That'll be coming out this week. It feels to me last year there is maybe one or two more spots available to host and a bigger pool of teams available to choose from to host.
We'll see. It's been interesting to say the least. So it's open. But a big series win for Louisiana. Both of those teams are in the tournament. South Alabama won the series against Georgia Southern, but dropped the game.
That's
there.
A no-no. They could not do that.
Keep you on the bubble.
I referenced that on the show on Thursday. South Alabama had very little room for air.
Yep. So that's where we're at right now in this April season with softball is concerned. So that's kind of the story for, I think we covered everybody for the most part. Victor, any final thoughts there that we maybe left out here before we call it a day?
Yeah, there's one story that I wanted to say, but I think we'll save it for off the air, or maybe we'll save it for a future episode. It depends on how Eric reacts to it when I tell him what happened. But let's just say, ladies and gentlemen, we got some pretty big guests lined up for future episodes of Inner Circle, on top of having my Monica Abbott on today.
We just had Monica Abbott.
I'm going to say, in addition to having Monica Abbott on the show, but it's getting close to that. We're getting one day closer to that time, my friend. And if this week is any indication of what's going to happen, Lord help all of us this softball postseason. It is going to be absolute chaos.
Should be a lot of fun. All right. Thanks again to Monica Abbott for joining us on this edition of In the Circle on D1 Softball. For Victor Anderson, I'm Eric Lopez. We hope you've enjoyed this edition of In the Circle on D1 Softball.
Top podcasters out. Good night, Canada.